Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to begin by addressing the supersession clause under Rule 41.02, which is triggered any time there is a conflict or an inconsistency between a rule of civil procedure and a state statute. The parties in this case spend a considerable amount of time debating whether there's an actual conflict between a rule and a statute, but I don't think the issue is that complicated. In the past, when comparing laws, statutes, or constitutional provisions, this Court has adopted a test for conflicts, and it's whether one law permits what another law prohibits. If so, this Court will find a conflict per Ashcroft v. City of Fulton. Now, I realize that rules of civil procedure are not laws enacted by the General Assembly, but they have the force and effect of law, and I don't see any good reason for departing from the test in this instance. It has a lot to recommend it. It's straightforward, it's easy to apply, and it ensures some level of certainty in terms of outcomes. And it also goes a long way toward explaining past decisions under Rule 41.02 and Article 5, Section 5. If the test for a conflict is whether one law permits what another prohibits, it's easy to see why there was no conflict in the Kinski case. Of course, there was no conflict where there was a statute authorizing the taking of discovery depositions in criminal cases, but no rule prohibiting the taking of discovery depositions. Of course, there was no conflict in the Missouri Public Defender's case, where the rule mandated appointment of counsel for indigent defendants both before and after the statute. It was unaffected. Both before and after the statute in that case, the rule's requirement that indigent defendants be appointed counsel remained unchanged. They got counsel. Now, compare those situations or contrast them with the situations in Reichert v. Lynch and Houston versus State. Of course, conflicts were found in those cases where you had a rule authorizing or permitting a civil practice, but a statute forbidding it. I think Reichert and Houston are very important cases. They haven't been addressed by Charter in its brief, but I would argue that they're actually controlling in this case. So applying my preferred test, the test I'm advocating, is there a conflict between Rule 52.08 and Section 71.675? I think if you acknowledge, if you concede that the rule authorizes or permits municipal class actions to collect unpaid telecom taxes from phone companies, then you have to acknowledge that there's a conflict, because you have a situation where a rule is authorizing a practice, but the statute in this case is prohibiting it. That would satisfy the definition of conflict in Ashcroft v. City of Fulton. And I think you have to concede also that the rule permits such class actions, because if it didn't, there would be no reason for 71.675. It would be a superfluous and unnecessary act. If the rule
opposing
didn't,
counsel says the public defender case is really very on point, because in that case, the rule permits appointment of counsel, and absent the statute, public defenders could be appointed, but the statute narrows the class of persons who can be appointed to represent someone so as to exclude public defenders, and that comparably here, the rule permits class actions to be brought. Absent the statute, cities could bring them in a representative capacity, but the statute narrows the class of people who can bring class actions to exclude cities and towns.
That has some superficial appeal, but again, the rules mandate that indigent defendants be appointed counsel was the same both before and after the passage of the statute in that case. Indigent defendants got appointed counsel. Here, in contrast, you have a rule authorizing or permitting these types of class actions, but a statute expressly prohibiting it. That
you're
is
saying,
a direct conflict.
You're saying the statute, in the public defender case, there was always someone else who could be appointed,
that's
whereas
correct.
Here, everybody who could represent the cities in a class action is excluded
that's
by
correct.
The statute. Okay.
The legislature has the power to act to supersede a rule, a procedural rule, does it not?
Undoubtedly. It has co-equal power in this area, so long as it satisfies minimum constitutional safeguards and standards, those being a bill limited to the purpose and a bill identifying, I don't think it's too much to ask, identifying the rule that you're modifying.
Expressly stating that it is modifying or enacting a provision that's contrary to an existing law.
Right, correct. And the legislature knows how to do that. It's done that in the past, starting statutes with the phrase notwithstanding the provisions of Rule 37, so on and so forth. Charter argues that even if there is a conflict, it doesn't matter because the statute in this case is substantive and therefore it's beyond the rulemaking power of this court. The identical argument was made by the respondent and rejected by this court in Gantt. It's also false. And the statute in this case is certainly not substantive. As was true of the statute in Gantt and is true of this statute, the statute is procedural because it only deals with the means by which the parties may assert their underlying rights. It does not define the nature or the extent of the underlying rights.
But your opponent argues that your cities like Winchester have no standing, and therefore it's substantive.
I don't see how that could possibly be the case. Winchester has alleged an injury personal to itself. Winchester's ability to bring its individual claims and the respondent's ability to entertain those claims, to enter judgment for or against either of the parties, remains unaffected by this statute.
It's your
Both
argument
before and after the statute, Winchester can bring these claims, its individual claims.
It's your argument that the statute only affects the capacity in which it can bring the claim, in a representative capacity versus an individual capacity?
I don't agree that it's a capacity to sue statute either.
Okay.
It doesn't address standing or capacity to sue.
Let me ask you this question from a broader perspective. A lawsuit is maybe not an extraordinary event, but not a normal event for a political subdivision to undertake. You agree with me on that? Why couldn't the legislature say that if you are a political subdivision and you want to sue somebody or some entity as a city, your governmental unit must make that decision so that it's apparent to the voters, as opposed to a class action where you are invisibly or maybe even involuntarily brought into a lawsuit? Why isn't that in the state's interest to say, no, if our cities or counties are going to bring lawsuits, they have to do them in their own name in a way that their elected officials are responsive to their own voters?
Well, that may be a legitimate legislative interest, but it's always tempered by constitutional safeguards, namely the arbitrary interference of the state in the affairs of a municipality.
Well, how is the state here interfering in the affair of a municipality? Just saying, municipality, if you want to sue somebody, you have to do it individually. You can't be brought in by some other municipality's decision.
Well, in none of these cases was that actually the case. All of the cities that desired to participate in these past cases have passed ordinances through their city councils or board of aldermen, authorizing their participation. There was no negative
But
option.
That wouldn't be required, would it, under your argument?
I guess it wouldn't be required, but we did it. Maybe the state has a legitimate interest in that, but I don't see how it makes sense to deprive cities, some of whom have claims that may be less than $100, who cannot obtain effective representation, how it makes sense to deprive cities from pursuing the cheapest and most cost-efficient method of litigation.
Is it really that much cheaper to bring a case as a class action or to bring a multi-party case, where every city's just listed as a party?
Is it cheaper?
The lawsuit costs the same amount.
It seems to me that the multi-party case is grossly more expensive and costly because you are multiplying the number of depositions, you're multiplying
Well,
the
all
of
those
issues,
depositions are going to be in the class action if you're going to take them.
No, not.
Aren't they?
You wouldn't be taking depositions of absent class members.
But of the members of the cities that want to participate. If the argument is that it's less costly, doesn't a lawsuit cost the same, whether it's brought as a class action or a multiple-party action, maybe even more, because you have all those class action proceedings and notices and determinations?
I'm sorry, I simply disagree that a class action is more expensive. It does concentrate the defendant's exposure in one forum for one judge. I would agree with that, but it's there's no way, I think you can reasonably argue, that a class action is more costly than individual suits brought around the state in front of in different venues.
Well,
I
understand
judges.
Your individual suit argument. I'm asking a multi-party suit where everybody is listed as a party in the same action.
Again, typically discovery is not available to absent class members in a class action. You have a representative standing in for those entities, which is subject to all the discovery, and whose cases of the class members rise or fall depending upon whether the class representative succeeds or not.
Even if the legislature believed the policy suggested by Judge Price was a valid policy, in contrast with your view, that still doesn't relieve them of legislating that policy in a proper method to overturn supersede the rule.
Exactly. It doesn't relieve it of the minimum standards required of Article 5, Section 5. It doesn't relieve them of the requirement to pass a bill containing only one subject with a proper title. This is not too much to ask of the legislature. So, running out of time, so I'll proceed to the special law argument under Article 3, Section 40. Missouri case law recognizes two approaches to special law issues, one exemplified by Reels versus Corson, which will find a constitutional violation if a statute creates a totally arbitrary and irrational method of classification.
But it says no city or town, so that's encompassing every city and town in the state. Why isn't that an open-ended class?
I always think that you need to look at what the statute excludes. And I don't think that is the only classification. I lost count of the classifications. It classifies on the basis of plaintiff, on the basis of defendant, on the basis of type of litigation. It draws distinctions between some utilities but not others, some political subdivisions but not others.
But if the court could find a rational basis for the legislature's reasoning in choosing telecommunications industry, doesn't the law stand?
If the court could find a rational basis, but it's irrational in the extreme. You have a statute that permits divergent civil practices in identical cases. It permits the joinder of plaintiffs in a multi-plaintiff suit, but not the joinder of plaintiffs in a class action. It prohibits class actions to enforce business license taxes, but two sentences later, it authorizes class actions to enjoin their enforcement. It permits class actions against electric companies, gas companies, water companies,
but
retailers.
Let's just say we want to protect gas companies, utilities, telecommunications companies, whatever, and so we're passing this legislation to protect them because we want them to stay in Missouri.
Yes, but it didn't do that. It divided a natural class. Charter argues that the level of regulation dictates the outcome in this case. That telecom companies are highly regulated, and therefore there's a justification for this this classification. But if that's true, then all equally regulated businesses, water, gas, and electric, would have to come within the class and would have to be covered by this statute. Charter also argues that this statute confers a benefit on telecom companies because class actions, quote, have extortionist tendencies which place undue burdens on the defendants. Now, if that's true, which we deny, but if that's true, then you have the legislature granting a benefit to one industry, the telecom industry, to the exclusion of other utilities and businesses. That places it squarely within PI, where the court found that a law partial to telecom utilities to the exclusion of other utilities violates the ban on local or special laws. And lastly,
Any other questions? You have more time later.
Now or later?
Later.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Much appreciated.
We appreciate your argument. Go ahead.
May it please the court, and thank you, Your Honors. Respondent believes that the permanent writ of prohibition should not issue in this case because the relators have not met the very high burden that is necessary to dismiss the will of the people as reflected in a statute passed by the General Assembly based upon a constitutional challenge. Every constitutional challenge relators presented in the last 12 minutes of argument to this court rely upon a fundamental misunderstanding of what Section 71.675 does. For each argument, both the special law argument and the Article 5, Section 5 pleading practice and procedure argument, the assumption is that Rule 71.675 bans class actions from the context of collecting telecommunications taxes by cities and towns. In fact, it does no such thing. The only act the legislature put into effect by 71.675 was to remove the ability of a certain group of entities, cities and towns, from serving as a class representative in those actions. In fact, before 71.675 was passed, just as after, there is no legislative ban on bringing class actions to collect license taxes from telecommunications companies.
And who could bring them? Because you have to be a member of the class to bring a class action.
Correct.
If you have a class of cities and cities and towns can't bring it, who else would have capacity?
Under the facts of this specific case, the specific class the relators attempted to define, they defined no one with standing to do it. Now,
what was the class they attempted to bring?
All cities and towns.
But you're saying someone else could bring it. The fact that they're banned from bringing it does not mean no one can bring it, but I'm not, in fact, it does mean that.
What I'm saying is the practical effect here would be exactly that, and we don't dispute that. The decision to define a class to include only potential class members who would not have standing doesn't mean it's the only class that could have defined. There are other forms of municipalities. I don't know if under the application of Rule 5208 they would satisfy the other elements of class certification.
But the statute they're attacking only applies to cities and towns, right?
That's not actually true.
Okay.
The license taxes are collected by other political subdivisions as well, counties as an example. In fact, there's a named county in the case, or in a companion case currently existing before the circuit court below.
Well, what's the rational classification to say we're going to ban this group from filing, and we've seen that the perfect standing if they were wanting to sue, and not others? What's the rational classification?
The rational classification, I think, when we look through the Jefferson County, let me answer that in two steps, and yours will be the second. I apologize, Your Honor. The way the rational classification test works, as I understand it, from Harris, as interpreted by this court in the Jefferson County Fire Protection District case, if there is an open, non-fixed class, as an initial premise, not based on immutable historical characteristics, there's a presumption of constitutionality. And that's the case here, all cities and towns. And to the extent telecommunications companies are a target or a class at issue, all telecommunications companies. The burden now shifts, the Jefferson County Fire Protection District case tells us, for the relators or the challenger to convince the court that the classification that is used is not one based upon a rational legislative purpose. The reason we know that can't be the case here is twofold. Number one, burdens are funny things. They place responsibilities and obligations on people. There was no record evidence below. There's nothing presented to this court in the independent writ proceeding that would allow this court to conclude they've satisfied the burden. But to the extent we would be obligated to address the burden here, it is very clear that both cities and towns and telecommunications companies have been the subject of historical, distinctive, separate regulation as a rational group by themselves, separate from the other entities that relators want to include. For example,
would you say other people, others besides city and towns could sue? So that wouldn't take you away from the suit situation if you say others could sue, but you're taking cities and towns out of it. Why would so that wouldn't necessarily save charter from lawsuits, supposedly, but why would you take cities and towns out as a rational basis?
The question, I believe, is not why would you exclude cities and towns as a rational basis. The constitutional question is whether cities and towns are a constitutionally rational unit to address on an independent basis.
Chapter 7, or Title 7, Chapter 71, exclusively dedicates numerous statutes, historically over hundreds of years, related to just cities and towns. Separate chapters of the revised Missouri Code address issues related to counties. We know from this court's analysis of Borden versus Thompson, which was a case from the 40s dealing with special rules directed to the dairy industry specifically. This court stated that when you're deciding the rationality of a category, you can look at the distinctive circumstances of the category. And the specific distinctive circumstance this court said was a good idea to look at in Borden was the long history of separate regulation. And the revised Missouri Code treats cities and towns different, not from each other, but from other political subdivisions.
But hasn't this legislation, in fact, chilled the rights of small towns like Winchester, which I think had like 1,500 people, from ever bringing a suit independently when they don't have the tax base, the resources to support such a lawsuit?
Two responses to that. First, to the extent there is a chilling, if it exists, the legislature has plenary authority to do that. It is the legislature, the General Assembly, that grants cities and towns, as other political subdivisions, the power to sue. It would be within the General Assembly's purview to limit the circumstances that it gives the city and town standing to sue. That's number one. Number two, the assumption is that there would be a chilling effect, for which we don't see any evidence that would be the case. The statute, 71.675, specifically ensures that both individual actions and multi-plaintiff actions, which have their own efficiencies, which have their own benefits to the individual cities, that would allow a sharing or commonality of costs to the extent that that's a benefit of class certification, to proceed in that fashion. The assumption, I think, behind the question is that the procedure behind the class action rule, 5208, somehow confers a substantive benefit on the litigants. And in fact, that cannot be true, because to the extent that it was providing a substantive benefit, it itself would be beyond the purview of this court under 40.01.
Well, the other argument is just the procedural rule. It doesn't do a substantive thing. It's just a procedural rule, and the Supreme Court, if not otherwise restricted by the legislature, in accordance with the Constitution, we're just saying this is how the class actions are pursued.
That is absolutely correct, and this is returning to the Article 5, Section 5 analysis. And to be very clear, the respondent in his order below, me arguing today in our briefing, we do not dispute the test. The test for conflict is, does the rule giveth and a statute take it away? What we challenge is that is not this case. The Lorenzi case from the Eastern District Court of Appeals articulated sort of in final form what this court indicated in substance in the Missouri Public Defender's case. And basically it's this. Can you read both the statute and the rule together and have them both be true and still valid?
But doesn't your argument distinguishing the public defender's case, I'm not sure it's addressed the point made by opposing counsel, an argument that it assumes there'll be someone left to bring the action, and here there really is not, and so in effect class actions are wiped out, so there is a conflict.
I would struggle with a rule of constitutional interpretation that required as its touchstone the discretionary decisions of the plaintiff for how to plead their case.
No, what I'm saying is you can say, sure, you can have class actions, but no one can bring them. But we haven't conflicted with the statute, with the rule allowing class actions. Clearly, that would be a conflict if the statute said, and unless the statute said it was specifically directed towards that purpose and met the other constitutional requirements for conflicting with a rule of this court, if you made the rule never apply, how do you say that's not a conflict?
If the class proposed by the plaintiffs was broader than just the groups of individuals who constitutionally lack standing to proceed, we would then proceed to Rule 5208 and make a determination as to whether there was adequacy, whether there was typicality.
Where do you get, can you also address where you get the basis for your argument that standing is at issue here. They clearly, under the statute, have standing to proceed. They can't proceed as a class action, but they are affected by this. They're, all the requirements for standing are brought. And in fact, the statute recognizes that, says they can bring it, as you know, individually or in an aggregate, as part of an aggregate group of cities or towns.
Yes, Your Honor. We know that Rule 70, or Statute 71675, is a standing statute for two reasons. The first reason is that this court in the Citizens Rural Preservation case talked about not just the right to bring a claim unique to you, but the right to stand in the place of others as a matter of standing.
That's an issue of capacity, which Wellston, City of Wellston, directly addresses. It's whether you have capacity to sue for others is entirely different from whether you're injured, you have standing to sue to pursue your rights. That's a representational issue.
Capacity would be a substantive issue as well, and regardless of the term that was used.
Capacity is very different than standing. Capacity can be waived if not raised in the pleadings. And I checked, and you have not raised it in the pleadings.
Your Honor, the basis of the court's order is not the name that was given to any specific defense. The basis of the court's order is there is a statute, 71675, that prevents the city of Winchester from doing what it's doing now. And that was raised the very first time the issue
right.
was brought to the court.
When that statute starts off with this language, notwithstanding any other provision of law to the contrary,
yes.
Aren't they specifically talking about the rule regarding class action lawsuits?
Your Honor, I read that to mean, notwithstanding any other provision of law to the contrary, to be referring to the original enabling statutes that give, in this case, fourth class cities the power to sue and be sued.
Well, if that's true, then why wouldn't we hold the legislature to their constitutional authority and require them to tell us that they are specifically overriding our rule of procedure?
Because that's not what they're doing here. And in fact,
you'd have to explain to me how this is a substantive statute then as opposed to a procedural statute, because it looks like to me it just deals with the procedure. They left the enabling legislation in place. They said you can sue, but you can't sue as a class action.
The substantive nature of the action is both based upon the language used, which is the same as Farmer v. Kinder, which is the language you shall not bring suit or shall bring suit. This court has interpreted that as the language of standing. And then our arguments, which the court can read carefully, may or may not accept, about the scope of what representative actions are. Is it a standing or a capacity issue? But regardless of standing, we do not concede the point on conflict. If you read the two cases that plaintiffs point out as most important here, Reichert is the first. Reichert, the rule said you may bring a JNOV. The statute said JNOVs are banned. You cannot both be and not be. You cannot do both. You can never have both. There's no circumstance under which both of those things can occur. The second case, the Gant case, the rule said in a custodial hearing, if a litigant requests a hearing, they are entitled to it as a matter of right. The statute said it is a matter of judicial discretion to give a hearing. You cannot both have a claim of right and not have a claim of right, and there's a conflict. We're very different from that case. One or more members of a class can still constitutionally be and still cities and towns can't do it. In this case, Your Honor, we absolutely agree. They've defined their class so narrowly to only include these individuals. Now, that, I don't believe, is a constitutional touchstone for making the decision.
Well, doesn't that conflict with your argument that they're a separate class and therefore it's fair and not a special law to treat them differently?
There's two different issues, Your Honor. And that would go to an issue of adequacy of representation when you actually get to applying Rule 5208, which we've never done. It is undisputed here that the city of Winchester, and from my reading of the ordinances around the state, most, if not all, of the entities at issue, tax more than just these specific entities and individuals. The decision to pursue a claim only against them, and therefore include only a constitutionally or statutorily prohibited group of individuals, would be a difficult test for me to understand why the plaintiffs and not this court and the General Assembly can be the architects of what would or wouldn't be constitutional under those circumstances.
Judge Azel, do you have any questions you'd like to ask?
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate your time.
Now you can continue your argument.
Thank you. Glad you didn't forget about me. Your Honor, this doesn't involve, the statute doesn't involve capacity to sue, as I understand that phrase, which I generally interpret to mean competence. Are you sane or insane to bring the suit? Are you above the age of disability?
Actually, Rule 5513 talks about capacity to sue in a representative capacity, and then class action rule talks about whether you have the right to sue in a representative capacity. So,
well, I believe it was your I believe you offered the opinion in the City of Wellston where you discussed capacity to sue, and you said it refers to the status of a person or group as an entity that can sue or be sued, and it's not dependent on the character of the specific claim alleged in the lawsuit. Well, if it's not dependent on the specific claim, and this statute, no matter what you want to say about it, the only thing it's concerned about is the specific character of the claim. If the statute is concerned about the specific character of the claim and capacity has nothing to do with the specific character of the claim, then the statute must be addressing something other than capacity, it seems to me. Turning to the single subject and clear title requirements of Article 3, Section 23, none of the parties here seriously argue that HB 209 contains only one subject. None of the parties seriously argue that the Highway Act is clearly expressed in its title. I don't see how anybody could make those arguments. What Charter urges is for the court to focus only on 71.675, because that falls within the bill's title. That falls within the single subject of the bill's title. It is safe, and it survives via the process of severability. And there are good, sound policy reasons the court is aware of, as noted in the footnote in Prestige Travel, as to why severability shouldn't be employed. But even if it is available, there's a good reason for not using it in this instance. And that has to do with,
I'm kind of jumping on you a little bit here, but doesn't the Constitution also say that the General Assembly shall pass no local or special law when a general law can be made applicable?
That's correct.
And could one be made applicable here?
Yes, and I don't think that's a terribly difficult standard to satisfy. Rule 5208 already exists. It is general. It applies equally to all litigants. It deters inconsistent results. And it actually serves the legislator's goal of reducing costly litigation by eliminating the need for costly individual suits. The reason severance isn't appropriate here is because of the fact that there's a severability clause for 71.675, but not one for the Highway Act. As Charter, the defender of the bill, concedes, faced with this framework, it is, quote unquote, impossible to determine legislative intent regarding the severability of the Highway Act. Now, if that's true, that's a huge concession, because I don't see how the court can then conclude, quote unquote, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the Highway Act was not a controlling purpose of this legislation. If true, if Charter's correct, then the good and bad parts cannot be separated. This court cannot say that 71.675 would have passed without the supporters of the Highway Act. To do that would require rank speculation.
Thank
on
you
this
very
court's
much.
Part.
Appreciate your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for taking the time to hear my client's concerns. I appreciate it.
That's what we're here. That's what we're here. Thank you.